It's a cold, dark night in Oak Towers in the Upper North Edge district of Sharn. It's just rained, so most of the surfaces are still slick and wet. There are people about, but in a wealthy district like this, who's really paying attention to what's going on far above their heads?
A half-orc with grayish brown skin pulls like the collar of his trench coat a little bit higher against the wind, braces himself against the eaves of this roof, and swings down and through a window, kind of kicking it with his feet, rolling onto the plush carpet almost silently, and turning around to catch the swinging window frame, gently close it again.
So stealthy is he that he doesn't even drip water onto the fine carpet. And as he looks around, you can see he's definitely in the right place. Fine artworks are on the walls. The mantle is decorated with small artifacts from across Corvair, and even some that he surmises may have come from the jungle continent of Zendrick. Far, far away. And cost a pretty penny, certainly. But this is not what he's after.
In the center of the room is a plinth with a unique item, a rod that is ornately engraved. It has runes and draconic on it, and it forms the headpiece of the rod forms a dragon with a knowing look in its eyes. Sort of, if a dragon could smirk, you would say this is a smirking dragon.
If one were knowledgeable in dragons, and he is, one would notice that this rod is made of brass. And of course, the dragon's face is that of a brass dragon. Is this important? Who can say?
Of course it's important. As the half-orc steps up to the plinth, he carefully sort of feels around the like under the lip of this plinth and gently triggers a latch, releases a plate, a pressure plate that he knows this item rests upon, and as he does so, it sinks just barely a centimeter into the surface of the plinth, in a seam that wasn't even visible from the top. And with a similar smirk, the half-orc takes the rod.
It's obvious that he has inside information about the defenses of this particular villa.
But he doesn't have all the information about the inside, about those defenses.
Because just then, a siren begins to wail.
As he glances around, just a brief look of panic in his eyes, he sees that there was a second trigger, one far more subtle, this one magical in nature, and he sighs inwardly to himself and then turns towards the door.
But from that direction, he can now hear thundering boots on the wooden floor and shouts of people to be roused to find the intruder. They're about as loud as he was quiet coming in. That way is not the way to go.
He casts about the room, optimistic that there'll be another entrance, but deep down he knows there isn't one. And he moves to a window, takes a look at the street below, takes a look back at the door, takes two steps, and then runs as full speed as he can into this window and smashes out into the cold, damp night air outside.
This, of course, is Sharn, the city of towers. The street is 600 feet below, and he plummets like a rock. In a nearby alley are two figures, one 6.5 feet tall, the other less than half that height, dressed quite finely and warmly in the cold air, The tall one leans nonchalantly against the side of a building, while the small one paces nervously back and forth, looking up at its tall companion, and then over at the very same tower that the half-orc has just dived out of. And as it gazes, it hears a loud smash and a small but growing figure hurtling to the ground.
Tumbling through the air, the half-orc takes a moment to orient himself, knowing that this might hurt. And as he turns to face back towards the window he just leapt out of, he sees the gawping face of one of the house guards, clearly content to see him fall to his demise. And as he kind of rolls himself back over to face the ground, he utters a small word under his breath, and his feet settle before him, his coat billows underneath the onrushing wave of air, and he descends the last 20 feet elegantly, guiding himself towards that very same alley, landing just as gently as a feather lands on a casual breeze.
The quick look back high up to the window, he gives a little salute and that same smirk and dashes off into the alley where the other two wait. The tall one says,
"Your filthy common magic is getting better."
The small one says,
"Yes, yes, very good. Not as good as Meepo's, but very good."
The half-orc, does disguise self affect your voice?
I think it's just visual.
The half-orc, in a voice an octave or two too high for his size, says, "Look, I got it done, okay? Look, that's all we can hope for." And emerging from the other side of this alley onto or into the foot traffic of another lively night in Sharn are Tez Proudgale in his finest cloak against the evening's cold, and Meepo and Skelebro.
"I like you better as a half-orc,"
the tall, emaciated elf says. But before they can get into it, as usual, Tez feels something that he hasn't felt in several months. A cold golden medallion that he always keeps in a pocket nearby begins to gently vibrate before becoming more insistent. And when he pulls it out of his pocket, he can see it is engraved with the letters R-D-E-T.
"Boys, we're getting a page."
High-pitched voice emanates from the medallion once they're alone.
"Hey, I don't think I ever said congratulations on graduating. Here's your gift, your first mission."
"Yeah, thanks, Erky. It would have been helpful to have, you know, a priest of your stature there to speak as a witness at my defense. But sure, yeah, no, we got through it. No thanks to you."
"Don't you know by now, I'm always there with you. You know, in spirit. Although I was actually there that time. Can't believe you don't remember."
"Yes.
I was very I was integral. Look, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You've got a job. I think you're going to like it. You are our, well, let's just say, resident dragon expert. Or maybe your friends are. Whatever. Doesn't matter. You're headed to Thrain."
And we'll find out why Tez is headed to Thrain in just a minute.
Live from the Mundangerous Tower Heist in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 301 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours. This is Actual Play Season 2, Episode 1.
In this episode, we're playing through A Deep and Creeping Darkness from the 5e Adventure Collection, Candlekeep Mysteries. Tez Proudgale has his first real mission from the Trust, He's also out for some treasure.
Oh boy, is he ever.
All right, so if you haven't listened to our first actual play, that's not what we do here. We are an RPG discussion podcast, but last year both of us had kids, and so we needed a little extra time to ourselves, so we did an actual play. People seem to like it, so here we are again. This is going to be a short one, 4-ish weeks. But the way that we do it is we're doing a solo adventure, like before. We're going to talk about our choices more than you normally would in an actual play. This is less a performance and more a demonstration of gameplay. And then we'll have a fifth episode that's a debrief on the choices that we made for this game, why we made them, and then things we might do differently.
So for this one, for the first series, you can find those in the feed. Those are marked with a separate numbering for the AP. For this one, it'll be episodes 301 through probably 305, 304. I don't know how many weeks are in January. So you can catch up on that. That one, we ran through Sunless Citadel. This one, we're doing Candlekeep Mysteries. Ishin, Candlekeep Mysteries is another book of a collection of adventures. Why this one?
Great question. Okay, so these days it's actually really difficult to build a consistent narrative with a through line using disparate short adventures from official 5e products. You could do something like, Princes of the Apocalypse, Storm King's Thunder, or whatever, that take you from level 1 up to level 15. But that's not what we started with, right? And we already sort of established, a character and a place. He's in Eberron, and there aren't published Eberron adventures. So I started looking around for published adventures that work for a fourth level character, and a lot of them just don't fit our existing narrative at all. I did, however, stumble upon Candlekeep Mysteries, which is a relatively new book that is a collection of, I think, 17 unconnected mystery adventures with investigations and solutions and things like that I think will fit the bill in several places. So we are going to play the one for fourth level characters, although it's going to be a little bit changed because you are solo with some sidekicks.
I didn't know it was 17 adventures. That's pretty big, but
The whole book, just adventures based on a book theme. I'll let everyone here know that I'm using A Deep and Creeping Darkness as heavy inspiration for this, but a lot of things are getting changed. So it's written by Sarah Matson and it's developed and edited by Michelle Carter. I think it's actually a pretty good adventure. You can do it pretty quickly. One thing I'll say about Candlekeep Mysteries, though, is it's a really dark book. I mean, this one is called A Deep and Creeping Darkness, but it's kind of like murder mysteries. So you've got to be on board with kind of serial killers and occult murders and things like that. Each of the, and madness and things like that. Those are prominent themes in this book. So speaking of which, let's go ahead and do a mini session zero and also talk about updating our lines and veils. We did a much more in-depth one for the last actual play, but since we're using new material, since some of the content is changing, and just because we are sitting down at the table again to start a new arc, it's a great time to revisit that.
Cool. What do you need from me?
All right. So previously, we sort of established both between us, but then also for the actual play that we want to do, things that we're going to avoid that we don't want to see in a game or that we don't want to see in this particular game. And those are things that are pretty consistent for the two of us in general, right? We're not going to touch on, sexual abuse of any kind. We avoid violence against children, torture, things like that,
Agreed.
We check in with each other on body horror and those sorts of things. But I think for the most part, we're fine with death and grittiness. It's a relatively medieval setting.
I think all that's fine. I mean, I think the other thing we're pretty hard out on is like any type of like slavery or bondage of sapient creatures.
Yeah, and that's something to consider also because like this is Eberron where that is canon. So like those are just not themes that we're interested in exploring.
If they come up, let's liberate them. How's that?
I mean, that's essentially it. Oh, we're playing characters who are good people. Well, then I don't care what your plot was. We're liberating the enslaved people. Like that, obviously. Yeah.
We're not entirely, like, I wouldn't say that Tez is entirely good. I just think he's got a line.
Right.
And that line is roughly where mine is, which is slavery bad.
So I'm going to check in with you here on updating our lines and veils, though, because like I said, this is a much darker book than like, well, actually a lot of Wizards of the Coast Fair is really dark. I think that in Dragon Heist, there's like a family that sold their children's souls to Asmodeus and like one kid immediately got turned into a chain devil. Like it's really dark stuff. In A Deep and Creeping Darkness, there is essentially like no spoilers because I'm totally changing the ending. So, you know, Shane, you haven't played this, but like it doesn't matter. And if you have played this, you'll still be interested in hearing the end of this actual play. But like, there's a village that basically all got tortured to death, both mentally and physically. And one would assume that a village includes children. So, you know, it doesn't happen on screen, but there's the implication, but also the aftermath.
Oh, okay, fun.
Right. So, what I would like to I don't want to include any torture. I'm not going to. But I want to know if you are okay with like the aftermath of violence against children. Not like child abuse, but like, you know, basically like caught in the crossfire of war, things like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is, the victims are already passed, right? Like this isn't dealing with survivors or is this,
Yeah, there will be some survivors and some dead.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I guess, I can always, you know, draw a line or a veil if it goes too far, but yeah.
Right, and we always have the X card.
Yeah, we can go from there. That's fine.
Cool. All right. With that updated, and also, you know, for your listeners, know that that is the adaptation of this. It is a lightening of the mood of this adventure.
Oh, that's a lightning, you say?
Yes.
Okay, great.
In terms of how we do actual plays, and I promise we'll dive in very shortly, we tend to explain more than you normally would, just so you know our thought processes. And it's sort of like a... Part of this is us musing about game design and gameplay.
Yeah, and then we always do a recap episode that we can kind of answer some questions that come up along the way, as well as kind of give some of our thoughts, recap sort of some of the decisions that we made and you know, things that we found interesting.
Speaking of which, so we're going to skip over the nitty-gritty, but we are using the downtime rules from Xanathar's Guide to Everything. Tez got a fair amount of loot in the last adventure. So we did some rolls. You sold it off for a pretty penny, I might add, at least 4,000 gold pieces.
Yeah, I mean, the stuff that I've already liquidated got me so much gold that I'm wondering if I donate any of it to a museum now. Because, like, I sold stuff that was quote-unquote worth 150 gold for, like, 400? Like... That's most of a magic item.
It's because it's all based on persuasion rolls and you have expertise in persuasion.
Right.
You know, like not even intentionally to like sell stuff, but like, you know, that's Xanathar's and item acquisition rules are never balanced in any game.
Right. So so I did some shopping spreeing. One, Tez has actually leveled up. So Tez is now level 4. He took a level of Artificer. And alongside that, he picked up a headband of intellect, which gives him 19 intelligence. He took Serpent Scale Mail, which gives him an AC of 14 plus dex, but no disadvantage on stealth. That's medium armor. He got Boots of Elvenkind, which give him advantage on stealth when he needs to move silently. Helpful when you smash through a window, for example. and then he took the best uncommon magic item. Or magic weapon he could find, rapier plus one.
Clean, neat lines.
Yeah, exactly. Simple math, nothing to remember. Meepo took bracers of archery to help with his head knocker and nice. Also took a dagger of warning, which has the added benefit. Like it gives him advantage on his initiative rolls, but it has the added benefit of no one in the party can be surprised and we wake up if we get ambushed.
Nice.
So that's a good party buff for Tez sitting in Meepo. And then Skelebro has Mithril full plate, so he can move silently despite wearing full plate armor. That felt appropriate for a former elf.
Who's now some sort of revenant creature and has, you know, is most comfortable 1800 years ago and not in weirdly modern society.
Also, that was by far the most expensive item that I bought. That's how much I love Skelebro, okay? Is I spent 750 gold for his armor and then another 600 gold on top of it to make it mithril.
You also destroyed your Nightcaller in order to create him in the first place, which is something I will eventually get into.
Yes, I did. That was Tez's experimentations Hearts of Artifice.
Right, yes. I'm a first level artificer. Let's see what we can do.
Exactly. I'm a first level artificer with a book in Draconic about dragons and the troll musings on life and undeath, okay?
So speaking of which, why don't you just take a little bit of time to tell us about like who Tez is?
Tez Proudgill is a half-elf scion of the Lazar Proudgills, who are the ruling family of one of the Lazar principalities.
Of which there are thousands.
He is officially a rogue archaeologist because he recently completed his post-grad work at Morgrave University, defended his thesis on the history of dragons in Corvair, and was awarded his degree. So he is by trade a rogue archaeologist. Along the way, he maybe got hoodwinked by a little gnome bastard who goes by the name Erky Timbers, who press ganged him into becoming an asset or an agent of the Trust, which is the spy organization out of the gnome nation of Zalarga.
Yes, he was literally impressed.
Yes, yes, quite literally. So you know, Tez is in Breland still. He's been kicking around at Morgrave. He's still living on campus. He as a rogue archaeologist, it turns out when you're in a city, you don't have a lot of extra, and especially when you went shopping spree with all of your last your last proceeds, you don't have a lot of extra coin to spare for room and board, and so he is still taking advantage of the recent alumni program. Though he has sprung for a double room, he is no longer living in a single dorm room. So there's that.
Interestingly, though, Skelebro and Meepo are not living with him. They live in a pretty swanky apartment, actually.
Uh-huh.
Tez has his suspicions, but he's pretty sure Skelebro knew of some sort of gem cache that was hidden several thousand years ago, went and unearthed it, and has been sharing with Meepo, but not Tez.
That's, I mean, fair. I did bring him back into this hellish featurescape when he was otherwise perfectly content to be a skeleton guardian under the control of my Nightcaller. What I'm saying is I did a good thing and I'm being punished for it. Okay, Skelebro?
As always. All right, so that brings us up to date. And in fact, the party, Tez Proudgale, Skelebro, and Meepo are ensconced in a pretty nice carriage, actually, along an Orion trade route heading into the far, far north of Thrain, up near the mountains by the Ondarian border. Now, after taking probably about a 3-day trip on the lightning route, and the three of them are talking over the information that they gleaned from the dossier that arrived at Tez's dorm before he left, and the information that Erky Timber shared with them before sending them on what they hope is not a wild goose chase.
First of all, what is my mission? Why am I going to Thrain?
Ah. Okay. Here's what's been happening,
Erky tells you.
It seems that for the past few months, villagers in northern Thrain have been attacked by some sort of unknown creature. Why does anyone care? Nobody does. Except that it's continued to happen over and over again. A shepherd. Alone. With a flock. Someone heading out to the well late at night. So far, it seems several dozen people have been killed, and about a dozen more have survived with rather gruesome injuries, often to the head and neck region. Jayla Darren, if you've heard of her, Keeper of the Flame, has finally decided to do something about this, and so she has presented a bounty of 5,000 crowns to anyone who can kill or capture whatever beast this is. That's nice. Here's what we want you to do. Find out if it's a dragon.
Great.
If it's a dragon, don't do anything else. Tell us and leave. If it's not a dragon, we don't care.
Okay, but if it is a dragon, then I can't collect the bounty, Erky. And if I can't collect the bounty, how can I afford the trip?
Well, doesn't seem like our problem. We'll get you there. I suppose we'll get you back, assuming you survive.
Yeah, I don't like our arrangement. I want to renegotiate my contract.
We don't have a contract.
That's part of the problem, Erky.
Yeah, hard to renegotiate. Anyway, have fun.
All right, so I think Tez is now flipping through several clippings from various newspapers that might have been reporting on these types of incidents, as well as any type of like geographical surveys. He's an academic, at least in part, so he's looking also for anthropological surveys, cultural surveys of the area, those types of things. You know, history of the area, all that sort.
So when you look through the newspaper clippings, the thing that's most glaring is the lack of information. In fact, none of these attacks have been reported on. And, you know, you can see why. It's like a pretty rural area. It's not heavily populated. People are always still a little annoyed by the Thranes in general. People getting attacked by wild animals in the woods is not an uncommon occurrence. Actually, wolf attacks have been down recently because since the war, they usually just dig up old battlefields. It's not the strangest thing that, you know, a person walking alone or tending sheep alone would get attacked or even killed by a wolf or a pack of wolves. The fact that it's been several dozen in the past few months, and the fact that the Keeper of the Flame herself is now involved, signals that the Thranes think something bigger is going on.
Interesting.
In terms of the terrain, so you're actually headed to a small village called Vermilion. Like I said, in the far north of Thrain, up near the mountains, the area saw pretty heavy fighting because it's near the Ondarian border, but not really. There's nothing important there. It's just the troops were back and forth as the front kept moving. So there are battlefields, but for the most part, it's like rather quiet folk. Farming and sheep herding are the main sources of income.
Was this town Thranish before the last war?
Yes.
Okay, so this is a culturally Thranish town that is now still owned by Thrain.
Exactly, and like if you wanted to check before you left, if you look through old records of the war, it was never officially like captured by Ondare. Sometimes it was occupied by Ondarian troops or whatever, but like the actual borders never shifted this far. So it's always been Thranish.
Is this one of those cases like the Civil War where like one side named them by the bodies of water and the other side named the battles by the town? And so it's like the Battle of Vermilion or the Battle of Crystal Creek.
Absolutely no famous battles, big battles, important battles, strategic battles in the area. I mean, over 100 years, people died literally everywhere in Corvair. So people died here, but never for any real purpose.
Never any actual pitched battle where like both sides lined up and fought over the ground. It was always just sort of collateral.
Exactly. And this area is not even a footnote in history.
Got it. Okay.
There are some very, very vague records of some of the attacks. Like Erky said, it's usually gruesome injuries that kill people or maim people, usually in the area of the head or neck. It looks like claw marks, or like a big swipe with a claw in at least a half dozen occasions. Burns. Which is probably the thing that attracted the trust's attention.
Indeed. Anything in the records that would denote what type of burn, be it fire, acid, frost?
It doesn't denote, which makes you think it's fire.
Okay.
Because the others would probably be noted.
Okay. And is there any pattern with the victims? Like any obvious pattern about who they were? Obviously, it sounds like they were mostly targeted when they were alone. Is that right?
Alone or sometimes in pairs, or vulnerable in some way. And you don't notice any pattern. Well, you notice only one pattern, and it's why it took so long for this to sort of come to the attention of the higher-ups. The attacks all seem to happen across a pretty wide area. And if you look at this, probably too wide for a creature like a wolf or a wolf pack. They wouldn't range that far.
Got it.
But in recent weeks, the attacks have been increasing in frequency, and they become more and more concentrated around this one particular town.
And is there any information around, like, the current state of the town, right? Like, population, size, leadership, anything about how it's organized?
Very little. You can probably find out when you get there, but at its largest, it was only ever a few hundred people. There's a mayor. But you're also pretty sure that with a bounty of 5,000 crowns, bounty hunters are going to be showing up.
Right. That was my next question, is who is my competition? And the answer had better not be Professor Kemble.
You do not know yet.
I will run him through.
You do not know yet. You're sure there will be others. Like, the only actual news coverage of this is the bounty.
Got it. Okay. And then just general question for traveling in Thrain. Something, of course, that Tez knows but needs to clarify for Meepo and Scalabro. Obviously, the Church of the Silver Flame, very powerful in terms of, like, practical and political influence. Any customs or traditions or anything like that that would be, like, necessary to observe as outsiders? Anything like that that we need to be careful of, especially given that we have a kobold and a revenant elf?
Yeah, the revenant elf might be an issue. Probably best not to let anyone find out that he's actually undead. Thrain is probably like the least cosmopolitan of the five nations, but that doesn't mean it's not cosmopolitan. It's about 70% humans, but every village is going to have a substantial population of gnomes or dwarves or halflings. And as you know, like, kobolds are actually pretty common in Corvair, you often working in farming. So
Okay. They're
probably not, like, this won't be the first time people have seen a kobold. They will probably be confused by Scalabro. You want to avoid looking like a fiend, looking like undead, or openly being a follower of the Blood of Vault.
Okay. So, reminder for Shane, was Scalabro a follower of the Blood of Vault?
No.
Okay.
He was a member of the Cult of Ashardalon.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Yeah, right? A Cult of Ashardalon was not tied to Vol at all.
No, it's just a fiendish red dragon that replaced his own heart with a Baelor.
Yeah. Classic. Yeah.
But then abandoned them, so.
Well, you know, as you do.
Mm-hmm. Got tired and moved on.
All right. And in terms of, like, the political structure of the town, right, you said pretty standard, like, Corvarian kind of, like, has a mayor, not like a ruling council or anything.
Probably not in a village this size. Yeah. Okay. And probably, like, rule is by consensus mostly. or seniority, you know, age, really.
Okay. All right. Or like just the kind of like pass down with one family sort of thing.
If you retired there and you were a great blacksmith, right, that earns you renown and people tend to listen to you, things like that.
Sure.
Right. It, but it's going to be very informal for the most part.
And then what can we expect in terms of hospitality?
Because the bounty has been put out. Yeah, you don't know exactly what the situation in the village is going to be, but you know, there has been an official bounty by the keeper, so if you arrive as bounty hunters, you're pretty sure you won't be turned away.
Okay.
After about 5 days on the road, the carriage stops. Meepo yawns, snaps his jaws open and closed to help wake himself up, and then pulls back the curtain on the carriage, peers out the window, and here in early autumn, it is unseasonably cold and unseasonably foggy. It feels very wet, but it's hard to see more than 50 feet away. A quaint, what must have been formerly perhaps even adorable little village, made of small wooden structures. But now that has definitely changed, as large areas that were, you know, common space for gatherings have now been basically swept clean and are covered in hard-packed dirt. And you can see about a dozen well-practiced fighters pointing longbows at targets in the distance, while nearby a cantor sings a hymn. And as each refrain ends, a volley is unleashed, and most of those arrows strike true.
Are these, like, Thranish regulars? Like, this is, like... Or are these... Do these look like mercenaries or, like, militia? Or are they actually, like, a standing army?
You have history, right? You're trained?
I do.
Yeah. So you can tell they're wearing the livery of the Silver Flame. They're actually emblazoned. Their tunics are emblazoned with the silver arrow that is the holy symbol of the Silver Flame. So... And actually, you can see nearby now, walking in full plate armor. I'm going to say, yeah, you can't tell the rank, but it's definitely somebody who's in charge.
Given how long I spent playing a member of the church, I should know this offhand. The church has its own militant ordo separate mm-hmm. from the nation of Thrain, that is also separate from the Inquisition, correct?
Yes. And your average person isn't really going to know about the Inquisition.
Okay, but I mean, don't people know that, like, they purge shifters and things like that and changelings, so like that had to have come from somewhere?
They know that they did purge shifters like 150 years ago, and that is a shameful time in the history of the church.
Okay. Well, as a student of history, there's absolutely no way that I would believe that that type of thing could continue on even into the present day.
Oh, of course. Obviously. Not. Of course. Yeah,
obviously,
not.
I believe in government reform, especially theocratic government reform. I am a student of history, sir.
Well, as that occurs to you, yes, this is Thrain, the place of the lycanthropic purge, where many innocent shifters were killed about 150 years ago. You look around and you can see what are definitely not Thrainish villagers. In fact, now that you are thinking about it, you spot a group of five shifters, which is probably an uncommon sight, especially because they're geared for hunting. One of them looks a little nervous, another seems almost angry, and one is calm in demeanor, but keeping a close eye on the man in full plate.
Somewhere elsewhere on the internet, there's an actual play of an all-shifter party that's about to run this adventure.
Totally.
Tez notes their presence, and that reminds him, like, he's taking a survey of who can be seen, looking for who the competition is. So there's the shifter group. Are there any other obvious mercenaries or bounty hunters about?
So in order to see, like I said, it's pretty foggy. You'll need to get out of the carriage. And in fact, the Orion carriage driver is basically telling you, you need to get out because I'm leaving.
Yeah. Okay, got it. Meepo, Skelebro, would you mind grabbing that gear? And I kind of motion to my hand, and it's in a brace, you know? It's like I'm still recovering from my injury.
I shall also pay the driver per usual.
Keep the receipt. We're getting reimbursed.
Scalabro just shakes his head, but as usual, does what you ask. Pays the driver, pulls down the gear packs, and then the carriage is off. But now you are in what was once the village center, and you can see all about you. And the man in full plate notices you and heads right over. Templar Duhamel, well met. He looks you up and down, raises an eyebrow at the kobold, squints his eyes at whatever Skelebro, looks up and squints his eyes at whatever Skelebro is, then turns back to you, because you obviously seem to be the one in charge, and says, you'd better be here for the bounty.
Tez stiffens a little bit, stands a little bit straighter, and says, we came as soon as we could, by fastest carriage available.
Sort of seems to let down his guard a little bit and says, good then. I'm having enough trouble keeping away the gawkers. As long as you're here to help. Although, I'm sure whatever's out there is going to kill you.
Yeah, trying to avoid that. Can you maybe catch me up to speed? There's been precious little information about this whole situation other than the bounty itself, and would love to get the, point of view of somebody who's boots on the ground. You know, you seem like an active, go do something kind of Templar to me.
Are you insinuating there are Templars who are not go do something?
I've never met one.
In half an hour, there will be a briefing. Gather over there. And he points to an area about 100 feet off. And you can see, as you like slowly head in that direction, there are other milling groups about. A fair number, humans, a bit like the archers that you see, although now you gather that they're with the Templar, and they're sort of here to like keep the peace and make this a base of operations while the bounty hunters go out.
So they're here to regulate the bounty hunters.
I mean, essentially, right? Because like you have a lot of like potentially powerful rough folk in town.
Got it.
But also, you know, there's also 5,000 crowns here somewhere.
That's the next thing I was curious about, who was going to be paying us.
You notice the regulars, and then there are other, you know, small groups of, you know, 3 to 4, mostly humans, some, you know, the odd dwarf or half elf here and there. Most of them actually don't look up to snuff to you. I mean, 5,000 crowns is a lot. This would have attracted pretty much anybody who could get here and didn't have another job. Mm-hmm. There are a few people, though, with your practiced eye that stand out to you. And the first is those 5 shifters. Mm-hmm. And then there's, you aren't sure, there are 4 elves, all of whom are mounted on horseback. You don't have animal handling, do you?
I do not. It is the thing I am worst at.
Meepo, however, who used to be a dragon keeper, looks over and says, good horse flesh. And you are not exactly sure what he means. But you're also kind of sure what he means.
They're good, healthy breeding stock is what he say. They're fit horses.
/ potentially delicious, yes.
Delicious horses, right.
Yep. Yeah, which I think the same thing. Escalibur, however, looks over and says,
the Valinar are here.
For my edification, the Valinar are the elves of Arinol?
They're an offshoot of the elves of Arinol, who now live in the nation of Valinar, which seceded from Seer near the end of the last war. They are I guess, what would you know from by reputation? Militant fighting elves who often ride horseback, and war bands of young elves like to test themselves in battle against any worthy opponent.
I turn towards Skellebro, and I ask, how do you know about that?
Tyr and Undal have long been an important branch of our people. They put their faith in the ridiculous spirits of long-dead druids, but you believe silly things as well.
I've never felt less elvish than when I hang out with you. I hope you know that.
Oh, right. Tez is a half-elf, yeah. But since he's a Corvarian elf, his parents are probably both half-elves as well, yeah?
Yeah. And Lazar elves, so I don't think they had any strong... Right, I mean, they don't have any, like, noble lineage or anything. They were literally just the most fierce sailors who carved out a spit of land, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, there are definitely plenty of elves who just think of themselves as Corvarian, or, like, Brelish or Thranish or whatever, right? Like, who are not tied to Arranel or Valinor or anything like that.
Right. Yeah, I mean, actually, that's an interesting point. I mean, there's probably a high likelihood that they are actually, like, their elven lineage is Valinor. Because they seem like pretty prone to taking to the high seas for some piracy. Like, it seems like those are the skill sets that would make a good pirate lord.
We went out to fight the Kraken and we never came back.
Exactly. Yeah. But I don't know that is culturally important to Tez.
Right. But yeah. So all you really know about them is that they have a fierce reputation for being warriors.
Okay.
It would make sense that they are here. Three of them, you know, seem lithe and graceful and powerful. One of them, though, is definitely in charge. She has the tallest horse. And then, interestingly, for an elf, she has bright white hair. It's not unheard of, but, you know, she's an elf. You have no idea how old she is, but... She doesn't look venerable age category, right? So her hair is definitely not white because she's old. And she definitely spots you. She makes you.
Hey, I'm a rogue archaeologist.
Mm-hmm. Maybe a little out of place. And then there are groups of sellswords here and there. And then one other person who does not seem to be part of a party stands out to you. They are wearing a very tight-fitting... leather vest and an odd pair of breeches and a hat pulled down over their rather large head, because it does look like a frog folk.
A grung?
Not a grung. Much taller than a grung.
What? 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 My heart is broken.
Maybe there's grung elsewhere. It's too cold for grung up here. Way too cold.
It's true. They're tropical monsters.
Right. They're poison dart frogs.
Right.
This seems like a... Well, I mean, give me a nature check.
Aha. Well, with my 19 intelligence, I can now do that.
All right.
And I can do it? Okay. 15 plus 4 is 19.
It's good. It's good. This is absolutely a bullywug. Dressed in, like, explorer's clothes. Which, like, look, it takes all different kinds to make Corvair. Bullywugs are not creatures that you typically see in polite society. But this one seems to be just sort of hanging out.
Would they be, like, more frequently seen in, like, Droam?
Yeah, potentially in Droam, but also, like, you know, the Shadow Marches or Kabara.
Okay, all right. Right. Yeah. So I wouldn't necessarily just assume they were from Droam.
No, not necessarily. But they seem to be the only one who's working alone. Do you want to approach any of them or wait for the brief?
Definitely want to go talk to the Bullywug, because I'm doing some quick math. I'm seeing lots of groups of 4 and 5. I'm seeing only one group of 3 and one group of 1.
All right, you walk over to the Bullywug, and it... notices you before you make it over, and then starts walking over and says, greetings, hello. It is nice to meet another human like myself.
You're good. You're a funny one.
I'm very good at human humor. Human humor.
You are. Mm-hmm. What's your name there, chap?
Hank.
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 It seems to like roll the word in its mouth like it's a toy. Hank.
He's rolling an H.
Hank.
All right.
Hello, Hank.
All right, Hank.
The human.
What you doing here?
I'm here to find the beast and save my fellow humans. I'm a hunter.
Where are you coming in from?
Flame Keep.
Oh.
Which is where I was born.
Do I believe that for a second?
No, you don't. No, not okay. At all. It is where my human families are from. When I was just a human tadpole, I swam the streets of Flame Keep, and now I'm here to help.
Hank, look, I don't know how to say this, but like this isn't working for you, this whole thing. I thought you were joking, you know, like us humans, because like, you know, you're a bullywug and I'm a half elf, and you know, my companions here are also obviously not human. I thought that was like a joke, and then like, you know, this flame key thing, but like now I'm starting to think you're maybe serious, and I gotta know what's going on. Are you all there? Are you okay? Are you just here for the bounty? Are you trying to throw me off my game? Because like, I'm a rogue archaeologist. I don't have time to unpack this, but you're weirding me out, man.
A giant sticky tongue comes out of Hank's mouth and slaps across one of his eyeballs. He licks it clean, and then the nictitating membranes flick for a minute, and Hank says, "What's a bullywug?"
I got a thing. I got to catch up with someone else. I'll see you after the briefing.
Yes, we are friends now.
Perfect. And I offer him a like half-hearted like, I'm going to shake his hand, and then I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing here, and I just walk away.
Please do not die.
Same to you, Hank. I think given how poorly that has gone, I'm going to go talk to somebody who is clearly competent. I'm going to track down the white-haired elf.
She's easy to find. You've noticed the elves have not gotten off their horses. As she sees you come over, and you know, actually no one else has come over. As she sees you come over, she turns her horse to face you. She's imposing, but not menacing. And as you approach, she very ever so slightly inclines her head to you and says, "Well met, hunter. Do we have competition?"
I'm no hunter. I'm a rogue archaeologist from the university.
She cocks her head. The university?
Morgrave University, rogue archaeologist. Tez Proudgill, nice to meet you.
She looks confused for a second and says, "The college?"
This again. No, it's a university. It confers multiple doctorates.
Sort of shakes her head a little bit and says, "I do not understand the ways of you soft outsiders, but I assure you, my warband is the one that shall kill the beast."
Yeah, about that. You're Valinar, yeah?
Tynardal.
That's the elven word for it?
Yeah.
Wow, that is a faux pas for a half-elf, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Tez says, "Wow, that's a faux pas for a half-elf, huh?" I am so sorry. My companion here just said that word out loud, and I completely did not notice. I'm so sorry. Anyway, yes, Tynardal. Great to meet you. Great to meet you.
This actually gets like a tiny smile out of her. She says, It is good to admit mistakes, to learn from them. Most never get a second chance. They just die.
I am really trying hard not to let that happen to me. I'm not going to lie. I'm just an archaeologist. I'm usually trying to unearth things that are already long dead. And usually they're valuables. But I got dispatched up here to sort this whole situation out. And I'm not going to lie. I am happy to let you go first.
Archaeologists, I think you'll find there are plenty of dead bones for you to pick over here.
That's not really my I'm kind of more looking for the valuables, but like, yeah, something's up. What do you know? What's going on? You've been here longer than we have. What do you read here? And I'm trying to give the impression that we are not we're not really competition, right? Like,
right.
We're too incompetent and unfocused on the task at hand. Like, we're fodder for whatever the monster is.
I mean, you are sure that she does not see you as, like, competent competition at this point.
Good.
So she says, you are the last to arrive, and yet already you seek an advantage from those you would best?
Oh, well, if you're offering to give me an advantage, I'll happily take it. I was kind of just making small talk. And, you know, maybe you could just kind of catch me up on what we're going to hear in the briefing.
She narrows her eyes at you like she's trying to figure you out. And then she says, they say the beast is a dragon. What say you?
Tez makes the same smirk that the half-orc made as he fell out of the tower a few nights ago. And makes a very similar smirk to what's on that rod. And he says, well, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't potentially a dragon. I told you, I'm a rogue archaeologist.
She stares at you for a long moment and says, yes, that does seem to be the case for many here. We shall see. And then she looks up at the Templar, who now seems to be gathering people, and says, in fact, I believe we shall see now. And then without another look at you, she canters her horse off and the others follow over to the briefing.
I turn to Skellebro and to Meepo and say, well, that went well.
I think she's going to kill you.
I don't think she's going to waste her time.
If you're lucky, Meepo can get her attention for Tez.
For what?
To kill you.
Oh. No, that's okay. I'd like to keep my head attached to my body, Meepo. That's sort of more my style.
Okay, anytime.
He looks up at Skellebro and says,
dying is not so bad, no?
Meepo, there's no Tez to bring me back to life. And also, it's kind of like frowned upon around here. Just relax.
Meepo, like, jumps. Like, he just remembered, oh, right, it's a big secret. And, like, does the thing he's done before where he clamps his claws over his snout to keep it shut for a moment. And then, like, nods vigorously.
You're too... It's amazing how fast you became city folk.
All right, you head over and you can see everyone has gathered. Duhamel is an imperious sort. He seems quite confident in his abilities, and he basically makes that known, saying, you're bounty hunters, you're here for the 5,000 crowns, but I'll have it known that my regulars will rout the beast and kill it before any of you are able to locate it. Still, the Keeper has determined that we should have as many people on this as possible to have the threat ended. So I shall share with you what information we have. And he basically gives the information that was in your dossier. Not the connections that you made, just sort of like the raw information. And initially there isn't anything new, right? The attack started several months ago. It was only recently that they sort of pieced together that it seems to be the same thing. They've been increasing in frequency and more centered around this particular village, Vermilion. And you notice, you think probably others notice, like, they're plotted on a map. Even from the very beginning, the attacks were centered on this village, even when they were much more wide-ranging.
Right. Does he give any indication as to why this is such a priority?
Do you ask that, or do you know? Do you want to know if he like brings it up himself?
I want to know if he brings it up himself.
Nothing other than, you know, the church is here to fight evil and save the lives of its adherents. He does the whole, like, you know, wherever evil lies, the silver flame shall seek it out.
Right.
And actually, you can see when he gets sort of like fiery about this, the shifters get nervous.
Okay, so I think Tez took up a spot sort of casually leaning against like a fence post sort of in the back, you know? And when Duomo kind of gets to that part of the speech, they'll just kind of pipe up from the back, probably behind the horses even, and is like, maybe this is a silly question, but why is the bounty so high? Why is this such a priority for the Keeper? Especially given you're more than capable with your regulars.
You sort of get his hackles up when you ask the question at first, but as you continue and say, you know, he's more than capable, he settles down a bit. He sniffs and says, you're right, we are more than capable. But the Keeper has taken these incidents under her wing. She wants it taken care of, and she wants it taken care of immediately. Why? Is at her discretion, and of course I would never question our Keeper. Would you?
Oh, certainly not. And I kind of under my breath turn to Meepo, and I'm like, I'm really charging a expedience premium in the gig economy.
And do you have, are you trained in religion?
I am just smart.
Just smart. All right. You know, like the Sovereign Host, you're a member of the Sovereign Host, whatever. You're an adherent of the Sovereign Host, right? You worship Aladra, sometimes.
When it's helpful.
Right. You also know that the Silver Flame is the second largest religion on the continent. Jayla Darren is the Keeper of the Flame, essentially the Pope. She's 11 years old. Among common people all across the entire continent, highly regarded as like a good, kind, wise person.
Gotcha.
Who like oversaw Thrain's signing of the Treaty of Thronehold that ended 100 years of war when she was 9. It doesn't seem out of bounds for her to sort of be compassionate about something that's happening here. It does certainly still strike you as like maybe overkill. It wouldn't have cost 5,000 gold to get these people here.
Does anybody else ask any questions? Like, I guess, what is the competition interested in knowing? Like, I know, like, I've already kind of gathered all this information on my own, so I'm not learning anything new, but I am curious, like, what does the competition think is important?
So they're asking pretty much the same questions that you're asking Erky. And some of them are outright asking the questions that you sort of piece together on your own. What do the attacks look like? What do eyewitnesses say? Most of them were attacked in the fog. It was hard to see anything at the time of the attacks. They tell disparate stories. And if you put them all together, there's no single creature that fits the bill.
Right.
With everything.
So that's interesting. Most of them were attacked in the fog, you say.
Or you know, they say I couldn't see anything. And when questioned, it's like, oh, right, it was foggy that night. It's not usually foggy.
So I will stay and politely listen. And then before anybody else is kind of breaking the group, Tez and Co will slink off to the inn.
All right, you slowly head to the back of the group and then begin to break off. But just as you're about to, there's a voice that seems to come from the air behind Templar Duhamel. A woman's voice speaking in common, and you can tell it's the short clipped tones of a soldier.
It's suddenly gotten foggy. I don't know what happened. It was broad daylight just a minute ago. I can't see anything. I've lost the rest of the squad.
Duhamel pauses, and he pulls a small stone out of a pouch, and you can tell it's a sending stone. He's obviously in communication with one of his troops somewhere. Adara, report. What's the situation? What's happening? Report. And he's sort of like turning to the side, so it's not like happening in front of everybody, but you can tell that like he's mostly forgotten about the audience. And he's just trying to figure out what's happening. And then suddenly you hear what can best be described as a screech and a and a wail kind of all combined together and a roar.
Where are you? Where are you?
This is the woman's voice again.
Come at me, I'll kill you myself.
The woman's voice again screams, but this time it's in pain. And then you hear nothing. And again, it's Duhamel yelling into a standing stone. And you realize the beast has struck again.
And we'll find out what happens next week. But now, Ishin, it's time to talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishin at Evil Sans Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrill.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at TotalPartyThrill.
And join the conversation on Discord. There's a link in the show notes. All right, Ishin, what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We are continuing our playthrough of A Deep and Creeping Darkness from Candlekeep Mysteries.
Well, that's it for episode 301 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishin. Thanks for listening.